Welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest today is Peter Carey, author of True History of the Kelly Gang, a novel. Earlier novels include Jack Maggs and Oscar and Lucinda. Peter Carey, let's start with the obvious question. Having read the book, I know the answer to this one, but many of our listeners don't. Who was Ned Kelly?
When I tried to tell my New York friends who he was, and I'd tell all the business, and they'd say, oh, we get it. It's like Jesse James. And I'd say, no, you don't get it at all. It's more like Thomas Jefferson, which, of course, was glib of me. But I was trying to get my friends to understand that that Ned Kelly sits right at the top of the pantheon in Australia. And so this is an outlaw figure, but he's central to our culture. He is our great hero. The question he's hanged at the age just before his 26th birthday for shooting three policemen. And at that time was a popular hero, and the popularity never really ceased. He continues to be a source of embarrassment for some people, of course.
In reading your book and knowing a little bit about the American West, I thought that the James Gang was a pretty apt comparison because they were certainly harbored by people in Missouri and they were very popular folk heroes. Why is Ned Kelly different in Australia?
Well, you know, just say you had a society where you didn't have a Lincoln and a Jefferson and a Washington. And let's just say that, you know, your greatest single story was Jesse James. You'd be imagining actually a very, very, very different place.
Right, sure.
But, you know, I would have thought that on the Jesse James story, there are two sides to the issue. And, you know, because it does grow out of the Civil War. And in a sense, there's nothing in that way if that's divisive, there's nothing divisive in the Kelly story. My interest in this was really, it's been there for a long time, but living in New York and thinking how strange it was that we should have this story, that we should be like this. And I started off thinking, who are we? What sort of people are we? And why should it be that this is our great story? And once again, you know, I had to go back and found myself drifting back to, you know, that old penal colony, which was the beginning of, you know, white occupation of Australia.
In a sense then, right, what we're looking at here is a way of Peter Carey and perhaps after that Australia discovering their own roots. Because the history of Australia is a strange one, particularly for Americans. And the only comparison, I guess, might be if we look at how American blacks think about the United States having been imported over here as slaves.
I think that's a useful way to get into it. Absolutely, you know, because Australia does begin as this penal colony. You get these people who are from Ireland and from Britain, from the streets of London, ripped out of their countries and their homes, transported across the world. And to this landscape, which is totally unlike anything in Europe. This is a very strange-looking country, this ancient leech soils and so on. And in this place, they nearly starve to death because all the things that they try to do don't work. And they have this really deep sense, not just the convicts, but, you know, many of the soldiers who are there are only in with this particular regiment because they can't get a better posting. So there is a sense about them of being a little second rate in a way. And so there's this deep sense of being cast out, of being second rate, of not being in the real place, and all of this sort of stuff, a sense of shame. And when these people start to be released and free settlers start to arrive, the big question about Australia is, it relates to the notion of the convict stain. Or the convict, even worse, the convict seed, you know, sort of a deterministic notion that you can't possibly have a decent culture in a place that starts this way. And I think this is the core of the Ned Kelly story, that here is a young man who is absolutely the convict seed, the fruit of the convict seed, who through his actions demonstrates himself to be smarter, braver, and fundamentally actually more decent than any of those that would wish to imprison him with this sort of concept. And I think even though, like all Aussie stories, which and in a way like Irish stories, it ends in disaster and folly. It is also, I think it does demonstrate this notion that we can be giants. You know, he comes from our, we are him, he is us, we come from that soil, we can be anyone.
It strikes me then that one of the differences between, say, the James Gang and Ned Kelly is that when we had, say, Wyatt Earp and an outlaw, it was the law versus the outlaw, whereas there maybe, could you say the constables were more like prison guards in a sense?
That's good. That's a very it's a very interesting observation. Never occurred to me before. I think, yes, that's true, and that's the history. You know, so many of them are Irish, too.
Right.
And, of course, you can understand and sympathize with them because they, for the first time in their life or in their families, can have a regular job and a regular income. They were like that. There were also, one must also say that there were, not all of the police were, there were a lot of really rotten police in this story. And if you've read the novel and you know that there are at least two of them have pivotal roles in the story who are just rotten. No one ever defended them. I mean, their reputations afterwards. But there, you know, there were policemen, you know, of some courage and integrity who you could say really were, I guess, more like policemen are meant to be.
There's also a tremendous economic inequity.
In this rural landscape, 19th century rural landscape, there are two basic classes of landowners. And their names are a little confusing because the rich ones are called squatters. And we're used to thinking of squatters as being...
Right, yeah. Squatters.
Squatters, yeah. And these are people who came in and occupied huge holdings of land. And they had, for the most part, you know, the capital. It's a hard life for them too, but they had the capital and the wherewithal to look after that land and deal with the peculiar climate of Australia, more or less. Now, the government at the time has this ambition to settle these released prisoners and these poorer people and to distribute land to them. And this, they have a scheme called the Land Act. And the result of the Land Act is that there is a class of people called selectors. That is, these are people who are entitled to select a small amount of land and have to, required to develop it in certain ways. They're people that are, for the most part, they're like the Kelly family. You know, they're poor, they've got no money. And they've got to work hard to clear it, and they're required to plant wheat in an area, in this case, where wheat will not thrive, although no one knows that, because they're so intent on reproducing a notion of something that in England. Okay.
What is the terrain and what is the weather like in New South Wales in 1870?
The weather in Australia, it's an El Nino weather pattern, and it's always how you get these situations. You have long, long periods of drought. We're in Berkeley and West Coast. You guys know all about the Australian eucalypt. So you get these explosive bushfires. You've got soils that, for the most part, are ancient and leached, very low in nutrients. And in the particular area that the Kellys are in, which is actually in the colony of Victoria, just over the border from New South Wales, you have this great stretch of plain surrounded by various mountain ranges, which for the Kellys will be, you can imagine them as islands of refuge because they know this country very well. And within those plains, there'll be some land on the river flats, which is particularly good. You can be sure that mostly this has been taken up by the squatters in various slightly illegal ways, picking the land out, the eyes out of the land. And there'll be land like the Kellys have, which is okay. It's sort of moderately all right land, but they've got no money. They've got 60 acres. You really cannot make it like this. So this whole scheme devised by an Irishman called Charles Gavan Duffy, who's still remembered and was famous in Ireland at the time for having solved the Irish land problem, you know, in Australia. It just was doomed to failure, alas. And so these people also, I'm not romanticizing them, they're not better than they should be. You know, there's quite a bit of casual theft that goes on all the time and a sort of a tax is exacted from the squatters by the selectors continually by the theft of a sheep or a cow and so on.
It sounded, in reading your book, as if it was virtually impossible for the convicts to hold on to land themselves or even to hold on to their own livestock that was constantly being appropriated by the authorities.
Well, here's the thing. Well, they're no longer convicts by now. They're released. But the whole thing is that the whole question of fencing. So you have your livestock, and it's very... They've got so many things to do, and they try to get their fences up, but they've got a, you know, and the cattle escape. Then the cattle are impounded, and basically, it costs them a lot of money and a lot of time to get them out. So the whole process of impounding is one where the poor selectors are sort of worn away and worn down. The squatters often don't bother too much about fencing themselves, but they don't need to.
Peter Carey, let's move slightly away from history and into your book itself, The True History, or rather, True History of the Kelly Gang. What is the relationship in your book, and this is a real loaded question, between fact and fiction and legend?
Well, you know, when I told my Aussie friends I was going to write this book, they said, "Why would you? We know all about him." And I thought, oh, yes, do you really? And the more I looked at it, I thought the Kelly story sort of, we do think we know. But the story is like, if you imagine this great dark plane, or a stage, if you like, a huge stage. And on the stage, there are these very narrow spotlights. And within those spotlights, and let's say there might be 20 of them. These actions take place. You know, the police are killed at Stringy Bark Creek, Ned Kelly's last stand, so on. And we know about these things. But there's so much that we don't know. And even if we know something like, we might say that Ned Kelly was a friend of this horrible Constable Fitzpatrick who was responsible for him coming unstuck so terribly. How was he a friend? In what way? So we all... And what... of the relationship with Ned Kelly, with his mother. Now, we know there was a close relationship. We know at the end of his life he's writing these letters saying, "I am a widow's son outlawed and must be obeyed." And we know very early in his life he loses his father at the age of about 12, and he and his mother, you know, he's the man. So we know all these things, but no one's ever imagined how that might have really been. Now, I want to do what a historian can't do. A historian isn't allowed to imagine the emotional life. Well, not in the way that a novelist can anyway. I'm really interested in the relationship between this son and this mother, because I think that's the thing that makes sense of the story. And so I feel at once totally free to invent any damn thing I like, but at the same time, I really, to go back to this vision of the stage, the dark stage, when my characters walk into the spotlight, into the known moment in history, I want them to come through the right door. I want them to say the things that they're thought to have said, and to exit through the door they exited through. And it may well be, having read my book, you're going to think something quite different about that scene than you ever thought before. But I'll get actually great pleasure from having acknowledged, you know, the bit that's known. But there's so much. The truth of the matter is that this is a novel. It's called True History of the Kelly Gang. It's obvious. It's a novel. And if I have to put a figure on it, I'd say 97.23% of it's made up.
But it's the other 2.7% that counts. As you're talking, I kept thinking of Tom Stoppard's play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, that in a way you're following Rosencrantz and Guildenstern through their lives, and whenever they hit the center stage, you're going to stick with history.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. There was a historian, Australian historian called Ian Jones, whose book I used. You know, there are lots of different versions of what happened and what happened, but Ian Jones has spent a lifetime researching it. So he became my guide to the actual history. And my copy is so annotated, so densely annotated. And even when I was in that physical landscape, which I went to often, you know, his book was like a roadmap for me. So having done all this, And this is a man who spent his whole life getting, you know, getting it, the, excavating this history. When I'd finished the book, I knew that I really needed someone who knew this landscape, who knew this story, who would fact check it for me. Not to correct my big imaginings, but to get, so the color of the coach was right, or the little details of things. And I thought, dare I ask Ian Jones? And my Australian publisher said to me, "You're mad, mate. You don't want to ask him. He's a historian. He'll be frothing at the mouth." But I'd had talked to him, and I thought he seemed to me to be a very generous man. And so I gave him the manuscript, and he fact checked it for me, and was hugely enthusiastic about. He said he believed the voice. So, I was lucky. He was a big spirited man, and would overlook, you know, my liberties.
You're listening to an interview with Peter Carey, whose latest novel is True History of the Kelly Gang. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover. You mentioned the voice. The voice of True History of the Kelly Gang is Ned Kelly's. And I started, when I read the book, I assumed that this was all a voice inside Peter Carey's head. But you say that he wrote several letters. Mm. So is the voice that we're reading here pretty much the same voice as those letters?
No, it isn't.
Okay.
In the end. But it is born of those letters. And the letters are really extraordinary. And I first read the longest one, 56 pages long, I read a transcript of in the 60s and was so impressed with it, I typed it up and carried it with me. I think one of the reasons I was so impressed with it, I was sort of new to literature in those years. And I'd just been reading Joyce and just been reading Beckett. And here I stumble across this uneducated Australian bushranger, which is what the highwaymen what they call. And there's a great, well, a similar, in his case, a disregard for the comma and the full stop. Joyce, you couldn't, or Beckett, you couldn't say that about, but still. But you get this great rush of Irish prose. And so I misread, in a way, you know, the uneducated man's letter. But I'd read it as somebody who'd just read Joyce and Beckett. And it so dislocated my idea of who Ned Kelly was. It was exciting, you know, a new way of looking at him. So when I thought to write this story, that's how I wanted to write it, in that voice. Well, in the end, of course, you change this and you change that. It's not Ned Kelly, but it's born of that style.
There are several characters in True History of the Kelly Gang. One, of course, is Ned. But the other one is his mother, Ellen Kelly, who one reviewer called a monster.
I know. It's very interesting, the different responses to this woman from readers. And I think no Australian reader would call her a monster. But people who love the book, often see her as monstrous and are quite angry with her. I for myself, in thinking about her, I'm working off the historical character who I know. Well, no one's ever suggested she was monstrous, but is particularly strong-willed and a very feisty woman. And who she's a Quinn, as it says in the book, and the police would never leave the Quinns alone. And the way I thought of this woman, this is a widow, it's at hard times. She runs an illegal illegal grog shop. She selects her farm so it's on the public road, so she'll be able to do this. I think, you look at this life, I think that's a resourceful woman. She's got to survive. She's figuring out how she's going to do this. She's got this big family of children. The things that she does, I basically think she had no choice in. I think the thing in the book that people are often very exercised by is something that I invented completely, which is in history, the young Ned Kelly was called the apprentice of Harry Power. Harry Power, a famous highwayman, bushranger, a man from Tipperary, sort of a rock and roll star of the rural underclass, and Ned held his horse and did things while Harry, you know, held up coaches and did things like this. In the book, for various reasons to do with, I wanted to keep Ned away from his home, away from the farm that he's passionately involved in wanting to succeed. And so I have his mother, without knowing it, apprentice him, literally, to Harry Power, by which, not selling him, she pays Harry Power money, like you would do for an apprentice, you know, a master-apprentice thing.
One of the curious facts in this book that I didn't know anything about is political transvestism in Ireland making an appearance in Australia. Yeah. I assume that's based on fact.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me tell you how that started for me. There's a fabulous series of paintings by Sidney Nolan, produced in about 46, of this story, which certainly helped inspire the book in different ways. And in one of the paintings is of a gang member, Steve Hart, sitting side saddle on a horse wearing a dress. And I saw this most recently in New York at the Met, and the catalogue's sort of helpful. It says, Steve Hart sometimes galloped around the paddock wearing a dress, or words to that effect. So I think, well, why? What's that? You know, so he's a cross-dresser. Well, that's a weird thing to have in that particular environment to be publicly known. And I didn't think about it much. But then because I was so interested in the links between Australia and Ireland, how much memory is lost and repressed or distorted and so on. So I was reading a book by the Irish historian Roy Foster. And he's writing about these social bandit groups, you know, the Molly Maguires, who were in the United States, are an example of what one of them. But, you know, the Lady Clare boys, the Ribbon Men, the White Boys, and so on. And in there, describing these groups, he says the things that typify them are the swearing of blood oaths, the electing of captains, and transvestism. And I thought, holy hell. See? So, I mean, this is a sign, right, then, that there's something that may... And so I start to read about this a little bit. And I even rang Roy Foster and talked to him and got some of the books. And that's, you know, so this is something I believe, although I didn't follow up back to do as much research as I might have, but I think it goes back to pre-Christian times. I mean, the men wearing the dress is a sign that all the normal rules of society are off. It's what you do on certain festivals. It's, you know, it's not there for disguise. It's there to say all the rules are off. And that's what in Ireland, some of these gangs, would call if they felt a poor farmer had been victimized or the rent had been increased unfairly or punitively, they would pay a visit. And sometimes those visits were totally terrible. I mean, you know, murder and mayhem and others. It was just frightening. So that suggests to me that if Steve Hart indeed did wear a dress, then there's some memory of this, and a political self-consciousness that we hadn't thought about before.
There's also what might be a homosexual relationship between two characters, Aaron Sherritt and Joe Byrne. Mm. What was the Australian society's view of what they were doing? It's hard to tell because you're writing through Ned Kelly's voice.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, I think that when I'd finished the book, and here again talking to this historian, Ian Jones, who you know, in his colloquial way talking about Ned Kelly's sex life and all of these guys, did say to me, I think the boys looked after themselves. I think from Ned's point of view, he senses that sort of, you know, relationship between these two guys. I mean, for me, I didn't want to make... It wasn't central, it wasn't important, but it was it was a sort of a Joe Byrne's his friend,
right,
and Joe and Aaron is another friendship. So I guess it was a form of jealousy on his part, I suppose you would say.
Is his girlfriend Mary a real person?
She is now.
Was she historical?
No, she wasn't.
She wasn't.
So the Mary really comes into being because for two reasons. One. Thinking about his sex life, and he's a young man. He's going to be full of it, you imagine. And I hadn't talked to Ian Jones at that stage, so it didn't occur to me that he may have been gay or not. Certainly, there's no record of any girlfriends or wives. He does seem like he was shy anyway, even though he was strong and a leader. But I wanted the book to be the letter, which is the book in a sense, to be addressed to the future, and I wanted it to be addressed to a child. And so, you know, the child requires a mother and so on. So Mary Hearn comes into it. And also the other thing about Mary Hearn, he meets Mary Hearn as part of, as a result of his relationship with this Constable Fitzpatrick, who historically is famous for being a womanizer and a drunk and all these things. So it's also, for me, helps to build the relationship with Constable Fitzpatrick that she should exist.
In your writing, what do you think, again, you know, maybe I'm overstepping bounds and maybe there is no connection, in the progression of your work, say, from writing about Jack Mags, the fictional Magwitch of Great Expectations, to going to a real character, Ned Kelly. Again, coming back to talking about your roots, is there some kind of overall scheme that your mind is going through here?
I wish there was a scheme. No, there's not a scheme. I mean, you know, each time I finish a book or come near the end of a book, I'm thinking, well, that's it. I'll never write another book. And I only ever have really one idea. I'm not a guy with 20 ideas waiting to be done. I'm happy to recognize in Ned Kelly something that I can engage with. The historical aspect of it, I recognize as a huge extra degree of difficulty that I've never had to encounter before. And I like to have degrees of difficulty. Of course, it's thematically linked with Jack Mags because both of these things are about, yeah, the convict, in a sense, at base, about the convict origins of Australia. But I really do, in a way, I sort of trust, I sort of trust instinctive decisions, dumb decisions almost, in a way, just following, at least at the beginning, what feels interesting and not thinking too much at the beginning.
There's an idea that we have that somehow truth prevails in history. Do you think it does or not?
Well, you know, whether there's the counter argument is in that line, yeah, that history is written by the winners. And one of the things I think of this title of true history, I really do think the minute you put true and history together, you are questioning the nature of history and the truth of history, and reminding the reader that history is another story. And this, I actually think that this novel, made up as it is, does provide a really interesting, I hope interesting, layer to history in terms of having we Australians at least asking ourselves questions about the emotional lives of these characters.
You've been listening to an interview with Peter Carey, whose latest novel is True History of the Kelly Gang. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.